This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For 2 years, both sides have looked to the Mueller investigation with real obsessiveness. For Republicans and defenders of the president, Mueller was their bête noire, the walking incarnation of an establishment that had it out for Donald Trump. A witch hunt, the president called it, over and over. For Democrats, Mueller was a kind of deus ex machina, a god who would descend and make it all right, who would report and reveal everything and somehow force Donald Trump from office. Not everyone was expecting the ambivalence of the document that Mueller delivered. There were no new indictments, but nor did it completely exonerate the president. And the document also punted to the attorney general on the crucial question of obstruction of justice. So after 2 years of obsession, where are we? What happens now in Washington? I put those questions to staff writers Susan Glasser and Masha Gessen. Masha, you've been warning about two big things for almost 2 years. On the one hand, you've been arguing that Donald Trump is every bit as bad as his worst critics say. You've even used the word totalitarian to describe him, which is
he would be if he could be. Yes,
if he had the skills and he had the system to back him up. On the other hand, you've been warning that the notion of collusion was a kind of fantasy that you couldn't really see as a possibility. Am I being accurate in that summary?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I haven't known, and we still don't fully know, although there's credible indication that collusion wasn't found by the person who could have found it. I think that what I've been more concerned with is that this idea that the Mueller report would come out and suddenly this nightmare would be over because we would discover that Trump had come from outer space, or at least from Russia, and would somehow be disappeared by the secret being revealed, right? I mean, there's a lot of magical thinking in that process. And I think that what has really bothered me is that engaging in that magical thinking happens at the expense of looking at Trump as an American phenomenon.
But don't we talk about that also? I don't know why one excludes the other. The riddle for so many people is, if in fact there was no collusion, then why did Donald Trump lie the way that he did? Why did he behave the way he did? Why did his aides take these meetings, these constant meetings? It didn't raise any suspicion in your mind? Or did you actually think that, well, Putin's not such a superman and he's incapable of putting together such a kind of master plan out of a cheap novel?
That's exactly right. I mean, and I think that's, and I'm not alone in this. A lot of Russian journalists and Russia specialists have been saying, you know, you're overestimating these guys.
That was the critique I always got from my liberal Russian friends, who are lots of them who are involved in journalism, is that you're made so crazy by Trump that you're overestimating the capacity for this kind of fantastical collusion to happen.
Exactly. I mean, what we are seeing us Russians when we're looking at this picture is we see a bunch of hustlers, all of whom are trying to sell something to both sides, right? They're trying to sell Putin on the idea of creating an American president. They're trying to sell an American campaign, marginal American campaign as far as we could tell at a certain point, right? On the idea that they have some special connection to the Kremlin. And then we see a bunch of naive Americans going, oh, that's the secret.
Right. It's like the idiot theory of collusion. It's not a master plan. You're surrounded by people like Roger Stone and Papadopoulos and all these other third-rate people. But on the other hand, you have is Paul Manafort is doing incredibly secretive business, criminal business, and he's running the campaign. So you can see why the suspicions were heightened.
Yes, and I have to say—
And real corruption.
Over the course of those 2 years, especially when Manafort was arrested, I thought, well, maybe I was wrong. Yeah, I started hedging my bets.
Now, Susan, even prominent Democratic members of Congress were speculating on television about collusion for months and months and months. And they were using language that went far beyond the notion of suspicious and why the lies and so on. They were saying definitely collusion. Adam Schiff is still saying it.
Correct. And I think that it goes to this uncertainty that hangs over everything. And again, you can't condemn this process enough, it seems to me. It's done such a disservice. I mean, you know, first of all, if Trump really is vindicated, then how can they not want this report out? Because right now it doesn't have the credibility of even understanding what the argument is. Because what is collusion? It seems to me that, you know, Adam Schiff's version of collusion is different than Donald Trump's version of collusion. And we don't know what Mueller's version is. It appears that he's taken a fairly narrow interpretation of his mandate. Did Donald Trump cooperate and essentially, you know, sign up as an agent of the Russian military intelligence, the GRU? And in that sense, he clearly has found the answer to be no. I think a lot of people who have looked at this closely, people who are Russia experts, never thought that that would be the case. And if that's the definition of collusion, you won't find a ton of people who were out there making that argument. You know, the question of a different kind of Trump campaign collaboration with the Russian effort on his behalf, I think, is much more where you see people who've been out there looking at evidence that's already on the public record and saying it's very suspicious. Because there, you do have a very documented record of not only the Russian efforts to interact with the campaign and this whole cast of characters that they're reaching out to and pinging during 2016. You have, number one, Trump and Manafort appearing to commit to the Russians' top foreign policy priority, which was lifting of sanctions on Russia. That is a significant foreign policy engagement with Russia and its agents. So again, there are enormous questions that if they are not put to rest, I think will simply undermine the credibility of Mueller's report. And Mueller, of course, is a man who both Democrats and Republicans for years have held in the highest regard. It's his integrity alone at this point that is essentially guaranteeing these findings, since we don't have the information.
Maja, a lot of the aftermath of this release of the four-page letter has been criticism of the press. Famously, Matt Taibbi, a Rolling Stone writer, said that this is the WMD of our day, that the failure to get the WMD story, despite large protests all around the world, the failure of the mainstream media with some exceptions, that as big a disaster as that was, what's going on now, what happened for the last 2 years, is an equal disaster. Do you agree with that?
I don't know how helpful that parallel is. I mean, I think that the ongoing obsession with the Mueller investigation has been distracting and, in a sense, destructive to the political conversation. Because of the expectation of the magic bullet, but also because of the way—
But do you think there should never have been a special prosecutor?
Not at all, no. I don't think that there shouldn't have been a special prosecutor. But I think that the obsession should have been toned down. I think that the problem with covering an investigation like this, and now we're seeing this sort of in full bloom, right, is that you're always reliant on anonymous sources, you're relying on leaks from intelligence officers, each of whom has an agenda and a narrative that you don't have access to. And that, in that sense, it is quite similar to WMD, right? I just think that it's happening in a different political situation. And, you know, and as I listened to Susan, I was thinking back to Orwell's quote that even to understand doublethink, you have to engage in doublethink. I have that, you know, that brain-breaking sense about this, because this investigation into Trumpism is so infected by Trumpism that we can't get our brains around it. I mean, this, the fact that we have an attorney general that you can't put trust in because you have to point out that it's a handpicked attorney general, the fact that, you know, the leaks that have defined this presidency are the story.
Well, another factor is that the most triumphant day in the Trump presidency has been the news, seemingly, that he is not an agent or influence in some way from Russia.
And then we don't even know what the news is.
There is that. Let me ask you this. Steve Bannon, Susan, Steve Bannon, who was a very important strategist for the 2016 victory for Trump, now says that Trump is going to weaponize the results of the Mueller report for the 2020 campaign. Will that be a successful strategy?
Well, look, I mean, you know, this is where Trump blowing up the conventions of our politics is still an ongoing thing. Any other political figure, of course, would be glad that an investigation like this is over and would want to move on as quickly as possible. You now see prominent Republicans, supporters of Trump, essentially begging him publicly, as Senator Kennedy from Louisiana did the other day, just to shut up about it and move on. Now, what do we all know about Trump's character at this point? The odds of him shutting up about anything and moving on are very, very slim. And true to form, he's already talking about, you know, various vindictive moves and investigate the investigator. And, you know, his advisors are demanding that Schiff be removed from his chairmanship of the Intelligence Committee. And so it wouldn't surprise me if this is a strategy that the president wishes to pursue. Again, it's a strategy that is very compatible with his overall approach of appealing to his own supporters and to maximum divisiveness in American politics.
Has Barr's summary affected Trump's poll ratings at all?
Well, there was just one poll out this morning that I saw so far, which suggested that the answer to that is no.
But still, I have to say, I his odds of being reelected are substantial, don't you think, both of you?
I do.
Yes.
Masha, you recently wrote of the Mueller report, at least what we know of it so far, that we've overlooked a lot of things, that we've been so obsessed with the Mueller process, which was mainly done in secret. What has been lost? What have we not been talking about enough? And what is the necessary reset politically, intellectually, in terms of what the media should be examining and thinking about?
Well, you know, I had this very strange moment last week. I happened to be in Leipzig at the opening of the book fair in Leipzig. And I was told it was going to be, I was seated in the front row, and I was warned that it was going to be a long evening because there were going to be five political speeches before the writers got to speak.
And your heart sank.
My heart sank because I thought, you know, I just flew in. I'm going to fall asleep in the front row. and then these people started going up, and each one of them gave a speech that was substantive, that was urgent. They all talked about things that were clearly on everybody's mind, like the crisis of the European project and the rise of the populist right in Europe and the importance of the written word and the storytelling at a time like this. And I thought, oh my God, these people are speaking and they're addressing the public sphere as though it mattered. And didn't that used to happen in the United States just fairly recently? And, you know, I'm not claiming that we were living in democratic paradise and then all of a sudden Donald Trump came and broke all our toys. I mean, I think their political conversation has been in decline for quite some time. But I think there's a kind of leap into the abyss that somehow we missed.
But hang on. Really? I mean, how much ink was spilled and pixels created and even broadcast discussion about the authoritarian nature of Donald Trump, about the many bureaucracies that he's degraded in a reactionary direction, about his effect on climate change or any number of issues? Have we really ignored these?
No, I don't think we've ignored them. I think, you know, I've seen this movie before. And
meaning what? Which movie?
Meaning the sort of the degradation of politics.
In Russia or here?
In Russia.
Yeah.
And I think what happens is that you get very scared because something happens, and then, you know, the sun rises the next day.
That's what normalization means.
That is exactly what it is. It's the boiling frog. It's the boiling frog syndrome. But, you know, all of us are participants in this process. And I think my dream is that instead of writing an ongoing story about the Mueller investigation that consists of connecting the dots on a daily basis and trying to put together leaks on a daily basis, I wish we were writing this story on a daily basis. What I think is missing is an ongoing narrative. It's a much harder narrative to construct. I don't know how you make it interesting on a daily basis.
Susan?
Well, I mean, look, Masha, I'm very sympathetic on the one hand to the idea that there has been this almost a feeling of like this is some kind of crazy bad dream. This isn't American politics as I know it. You know, many people, when you talk to them, right, they articulate this idea like every morning I have to wake up and check myself, you know, is this really happening in America? So I understand that there was an element of a sort of Mueller redemption fantasy. But if you actually look at, you know, the coverage, that is not really what was at the heart of the very good, I think, and very important reporting on this. I think that we have been covering this as an ongoing unrolling of Trump's challenges to our core institutions and to, you know, essentially basic norms of democracy, right? I mean, that is the ongoing daily drama of the Trump presidency. And because the Mueller investigation was mostly in secret, in fact, it wasn't that we were covering, say, public hearings a la Iran-Contra in lieu of covering those daily extraordinary things from Trump. I do think that we are accommodating ourselves to extraordinary changes in our political system that are more significant than people like to believe. In many ways, I find as worrisome the current notion, well, our institutions have held, you know, it'll snap back whenever he leaves. I find that narrative as worrisome as the kind of Mueller's going to save us narrative, which I actually think is a little bit of a straw man.
Susan Glasser and Masha Gessen, both staff writers at The New Yorker. You can find everything they've written on Trump, Russia, Mueller, you name it, at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Go to any of the great museums of the world and you'll notice the name of the Sackler family. The Sacklers have donated museum wings, whole museums even, and they've funded cancer research, medical schools, a long list of things. But in recent weeks, some of these institutions have said that they are no longer taking donations from the Sacklers. That's because members of the Sackler family own Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin. OxyContin was first advertised as a breakthrough, an opioid that would manage pain better and would actually reduce the potential for drug addiction. 2 decades later, I hardly need to tell you, OxyContin is a name that's become infamous as one of the drivers of an opioid epidemic that has now cost over 200,000 lives. Dozens of lawsuits have been filed. Just last week, Purdue Pharma settled with the state of Oklahoma for $270 million in damages. The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe has reported extensively on the company. And one of the people he spoke to was a former sales rep, a whistleblower who saw deep problems with Purdue's marketing of the drug. Stephen May started there in 1999 as sales of OxyContin were booming. Patrick spoke with him in 2017.
Tell me, for starters, how did you first come to get into pharmaceutical sales?
Well, actually, I had a neighbor that lived near me back in the late 90s who was a pharmaceutical sales representative, and I saw that he had a really successful career, and you know, it was something that I personally wanted to get into. I mean, I knew that the economic benefit was pretty good, so he helped me to get in with his company, which I did in 1998, and started working for a company that actually sold a combination opioid. So I was in the market of Purdue. So I was very familiar with the OxyContin product before even joining Purdue, and knowing the growth that they were having. When there was an opportunity to join, you know, what was perceived to be the best company to work for in the industry, I basically jumped at it.
And where were you exactly? Like, what region were you in?
I was basically covering southwestern Virginia and parts of Southern West Virginia.
I see. And were there were certain kind of marketing, I know that in some of the early marketing campaigns, what they would say is that OxyContin was the drug to start with and to stay with. Did you hear that when you were there?
Oh, I use that quite frequently. Yeah, start with and stay with. So basically, the idea is this. You've got a physician that is prescribing a lot of Lortab or Vicodin, and those are the combination opiates with hydrocodone or Percocet or oxycodone that the patient is taking every 4 to 6 hours. Well, doctor, if you recognize early on that they're going to have to take an opiate, why not just go ahead and start them on 10 milligrams of OxyContin twice a day instead of getting into that habit forming, you know, 4 or 6 times a day? So you could start with a low dose 10 milligrams. If you think about it, 10 milligrams delivered over a period of 12 hours is the same or even less than if a patient took, you know, 5 milligrams of hydrocodone or Percocet every 4 or 6 hours. And at the same time, you're not getting that peak and then that trough and then that peak and then that trough. It's basically a much smoother delayed absorption of the product over a period of 12 hours.
But that's so fascinating. So actually, part of the sale for you guys was that OxyContin might be less prone to addiction and abuse than other drugs.
Yeah, I think the word that was used more often would be habit forming in that case.
I see.
You know, it's habit forming to use something every 4 hours as opposed to 12 hours.
Yeah, though I mean, you can use something every 12 hours and have it be a habit as well.
Exactly.
But when you were talking to those physicians, did you get the sense that some of them might be prescribing the drug more frequently, like on a more frequent dosing schedule to their patients?
Yeah, I mean, you would have doctors tell you that they were doing that. And what was absolutely crucial as a sales rep to protect your own job, to, you know, is, well, you have to promote the product according to the label. I mean, we're talking about class two medications here. You can get in a lot of trouble. So it was always trying to get the doctor back to, hey, listen, this is a 12-hour drug. I know you said that your patients need to take it, you know, 3 times a day, every 8 hours, but it's a 12-hour drug. That's the way it's supposed to be prescribed.
And when they told you that in some instances, maybe the patients needed it 3 times a day and they would be prescribing it as that, did it strike you at all that if that was what was happening, then the whole kind of marketing thrust that you only needed it twice a day might not actually be true?
It's possible, yes. At the same time, we would also instruct the doctor if they're having to take it every 8 hours versus every 12 hours, perhaps the patient needs to be titrated upwards on the drug to a higher dose.
I see. And so they would take it just twice a day but with a higher dose each time.
Exactly. Exactly. That would be the appropriate thing to do.
Gotcha. I mean, it's interesting. So you're going in there, you're meeting with doctors, you're showing them literature to support the drug. But you're not a doctor, right? You're not a clinician. How comfortable were you with the science of it? I mean, did you have to kind of prepare in advance for questions that you might get from the doctors and know what types of answers you would give them?
Well, that's part of the training that we go to. We spend 3 weeks literally not only learning about the product itself, but you learn about the background of the product. In this case, it was pain management. We learn about the history of pain management. And then you spend a lot of time going through common objections that the doctors would give you.
What kinds of common objections?
Well, I mean, I guess the most common objection that I heard after joining the company was, well, it's just too addictive. I mean, we've got too many problems in our community with, you know, overdose deaths. And so basically, a lot of time was spent trying to overcome the doctor's objections on that and trying to refocus them and saying, you know, yes, there's going to be people out there that are going to abuse or divert the drug. But basically, we were trained, let's focus on treating the legitimate pain patients. You know, and if we can focus on treating those patients, then we'll have the outcomes and the doctors will prescribe the products.
Well, this is another thing I wanted to ask you about is, so you go out there and the first and biggest objection that you're encountering is, well, geez, you know, aren't these things really addictive? Did you believe that they weren't? Was the company telling you that they weren't? Were there studies or was there data that you could give to doctors to say, no, actually, you've got it wrong. This isn't addictive?
Well, I mean, early on, one of the biggest things that I would use, I mean, I memorized the specific line in the package insert that was later changed by the FDA, and that was the delayed absorption of the OxyContin was believed to reduce the abuse liability of the drug. You know, that was one of the things that we're trying to express to physicians. Now, that I think that worked for a while, but it wasn't very long into my experience with the company that, if they crush up the medication, then that kind of destroys the long-acting delivery system. So, well,
because people were crushing the pills and snorting them or injecting them,
melting them. Exactly. So there was ways to get around that, and eventually, I think the FDA changed the labeling of that. And at some point, we were told that we could no longer use that particular language.
So let me understand this. So you get recruited to go work at Purdue Pharma, which has this super elite sales force. It's got this blockbuster product. They're paying better than a lot of other pharmaceutical companies are. And then you actually get down there on the ground, and it sounds like already there's blowback because in the communities, people realize that there's abuse and addiction. So, I mean, that must have been kind of disillusioning for you, I would think.
It was. I mean, I started seeing it early on. One of my experiences was I think at the time it was a representative who was either the previous national sales rep of the year or they were on track to becoming the national sales representative of the year. So they would come in to help train us, to watch them handle objections from physicians. So we went into a doctor's office in West Virginia and, you know, we were pulled aside and advised that a family member of that particular doctor had died over as a result of an overdose of OxyContin. So that was a pretty significant blow that we both had. So I call that the day that it really hit really close to home for me. And, you know.
And what year was that roughly?
Oh, that was within a month or two after me joining with the company. In 2000, yeah.
And you stayed on for another 5 years.
Yes.
So what did you tell yourself? I mean, did you think these were just isolated incidents or?
You know, quite frankly, I mean, what do you tell yourself? I mean, you really believe that you're doing a righteous duty by trying to treat pain, you know, and you're trying to focus, trying to get physicians on using the product for legitimate pain patients to use the product the right way. I mean, that was my personal focus. And at the same time, it was still a good company to work for. There was more and more challenges. I think we really, as a company, first started seeing the challenges in West Virginia and southern West Virginia and parts of what anybody calls Appalachia. But you really feel like you're doing something good. And at the same time, you're recognizing that, hey, look, this is a company that I could work for a long time. They're going to have other products down the road. So you stay with it for that reason, because there's an opportunity for personal growth.
I see. And were you feeling pressure from the company to keep growing the territory?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, how do we turn the doctors' minds away from the bad news of what was happening in the community and get them focused on treating the legitimate chronic pain patients? So, yeah, there was a constant push on that.
And you eventually were part of a whistleblower lawsuit against Purdue. Is that right?
That's correct.
But it got dismissed.
Yeah, it was dismissed. I mean, it had been in the court system for many years. It's not hard for anybody to look up any information about it. It's Radcliffe May v. Purdue. We had specific allegations that the company had committed fraud, and eventually it was dismissed on a technicality.
It was a procedural basis for dismissing it.
That's my understanding, correct.
Looking back now, a lot of observers feel that while there are obviously a bunch of companies that make prescription painkillers, which are abused, that Purdue Pharma played kind of an instrumental, special role in precipitating the opioid crisis because the company pushed really aggressively to destigmatize the long-term use of strong opioids. How do you feel looking back? I mean, do you feel as though Purdue has any culpability in getting us to where we are today and in the opioid crisis?
Well, I believe they were absolutely instrumental in it. The culpability is you can't turn a blind eye to the problems that you're creating in the community. And that's one of the things I want to say to the Sackler family. Stand up. Be responsible. Be proud of your company. Okay, you built a great company. But also take some responsibility for the problems that has been caused by the way that your products were being promoted and how your products were being abused. And at the same time, you're still pushing the promotion of that product that's destroying communities today. I mean, I can't say it any other way. Be accountable.
And is there any sense in which you on a personal level look back and feel any guilt or feel any as though you personally have any culpability?
I think as an individual, you're doing your job. You believe that you're doing it righteously. You don't want to do wrong. You want to help people. At the same time, looking back, you go, wow, perhaps I probably should have resigned from the company early on and just walked away from a situation that was growing bad. But at the same time, you look, what was the information that I had at the time? Was there a way to turn this thing around? At the time, I believe there was. But looking back, it saddens me that I was a part of it. I'll say it that way.
That was Stephen May, a former sales rep for Purdue Pharma, talking with The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe. Patrick's piece about the selling of OxyContin called Empire of Pain was published in The New Yorker in 2017, and I spoke with him then. Now, Patrick, we just heard Stephen May lay blame for the consequences of opioid addictions on the Sackler family. The fact that Purdue is privately held by the descendants of two brothers, how has that affected how it does business now?
Well, it's a very secret company. It always has been. If this was a publicly traded pharmaceutical company, you'd have shareholders, you'd have earnings calls, you'd have quarterly reports, and there would be a check, a kind of an outside check. But really, this company is the kind of private realm of this one family, and they own it, they control it, they're on the board, the profits all flow to the family. And what this means is when you get into some of these dicey questions about selling a very addictive substance to lots and lots of people, what may be complicated ethical questions that normally you would be able to subject to a kind of a larger review in a publicly traded company, really they're just decided by the family, and we don't know what goes into that decision making.
What do you think their defense will be?
David, I've wondered about that. And I thought to myself, you know, there might be a kind of libertarian case that could be made, which is essentially in the same way that if you own a firearms company, right? Well, we put a product out there in the world. It's dangerous if used incorrectly, but ultimately this is a question of individual responsibility.
A libertarian argument in the world of pharmaceuticals?
Can you imagine?
We're seeing a staggering tragic number of deaths from overdoses because of this epidemic, especially from heroin, which is deadly and very cheap on the street. OxyContin is legal, and it's regulated. So why is it such a problem?
Well, here's the answer. For thousands of years, people have cultivated poppies, and we've known about the therapeutic benefits of opium-related narcotics. We've also known for thousands of years that they're really addictive, and this has always been the two sides of the coin. When Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family set out to sell OxyContin, what they wanted to do was destigmatize strong opioids. The whole idea was, we've got doctors out there who are reluctant to prescribe these. How do we change their minds? And they set out to change their minds, and they were incredibly effective. So the real issue with the heroin is that once the country is flooded with these opioids, you get a lot of people getting addicted. And once that genie is out of the bottle, it gets very hard to put it back. So Purdue Pharma, other companies, have tried to prevent their pills in more recent years from going to the black market, from getting crushed, from being abused. But it's kind of too late. And in an awful paradox, the harder it gets for somebody who's already addicted to opioids to get access through their doctor to opioids, the more likely it is that they're going to be buying them on the street. It may be too expensive, and they end up buying heroin, which is cheaper. And this is where we get the spike in heroin.
Did the Sackler family make any efforts to right a wrong?
Well, they would tell you that they did, in that Purdue Pharma reformulated OxyContin in 2010, making it harder to crush and snort. But I talked to people who said, you really have to look at the timing of this, because they reformulated OxyContin in 2010, but the patent on the drug was set to expire in 2013. This is something you actually typically find in the life cycle of a branded narcotic, is just as the exclusive patent is about to expire, you tweak the formula in some way so as to make it seem that much different. And then what happens is you reset the clock on your exclusive right to produce it. So they would tell you they had. What's interesting is if you look at their philanthropy, this is a family that gives to cancer research. They give to medical schools. They give to art museums, universities. There's nothing for the opioid crisis, nothing for addiction treatment. If there is any sense in that family that they bear any moral culpability for where we are today, they're not acting on it.
Patrick, it's an astonishing piece of journalism. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Patrick Radden-Keefe's article about Purdue Pharma from 2017 is called Empire of Pain, and you can find it at newyorker.com. The company is now facing dozens of lawsuits from states and municipalities, and there's even been talk that it may declare bankruptcy. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The list of cartoonists who are household names is a very short list. But Roz Chast is certainly at the top of it. She's been publishing in The New Yorker since she was 24, and her book, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2014. Her cartoons stand out for how personal they are. They're about marital tensions and the stress of dealing with your crazy parents and your even crazier children. In her drawings, everyone looks completely frazzled, even the animals.
Hi, I'm Liana Fink. We are outside Roz Chast's house in Connecticut, and I brought her some flowers that might be a bit too romantic.
I made it. Oh my God, you're beautiful. Thank you so much. Come on in.
Liana Fink grew up studying Roz's cartoons, and she started contributing her own cartoons to The New Yorker a few years ago when she was 27. They share a certain stressed-out line and a love of birds.
This is Jackie. She is a caique. She's very unshy.
She looks like a Disney character. She has these big eyes.
She's a little bit of a cartoon bird.
I've been falling in love with Jackie. She's trembling while I pet her. I was a really shy kid, and I've always felt really comfortable with animals because they don't do the things that I feel like I have to pretend to do, like hold conversations that are really hard for me. So I always feel connected to pigeons. I feel like they're these wild creatures in the city, and I'm like that too.
Jackie's a very good bird. This is my very neurotic and very sweet African Grey, and she says many, many things. As you can see, she plucks.
She looks like a lion because she has this plucked body and this regal head.
Hey, Eli, what's this?
That's water.
That's right. What a smart bird. What a smart, smart bird. This is a list of the things that she says, by the way. She says chirp. She says chirp, chirp, chirp. Who cares? When she gets scared, sometimes she'll say to herself, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Yeah. Which is, you know, self-soothing kind of thing. Yeah, she knows.
Yeah, I do too.
I mean, yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's okay.
I say fearless.
Sometimes I say, people do this. Yeah. You know, like when I'm driving, especially, because driving and I are not good friends.
You had a cartoon about driving where you just tell the story of driving, but you call it sailing instead of driving.
Yeah, it is. I thought maybe if I did a cartoon where I was comfortable with it, like somehow like I would actually become more comfortable. But gradually it's better than it was when I started. But I mean, it worked. The cartoon worked. I still getting lost is, I mean, the GPS is good, but then I worry about the GPS going out.
I read your work most deeply when I was in high school and college. I think that's why I love The New Yorker. I mean, I know it. I think I was 14 when I found your work, and we had just moved to this suburban kind of fancy, kind of waspy town in New Jersey. And I related so much as this kind of outsider and as a person who drew and as a shy kid and as a Jew, like it just completely summarized my world. And you got a lot of zeitgeisty stuff in there too. Like it was much more intense than rereading an old diary or looking at photographs or something. I feel like you really caught that era and caught my life. And how do you feel when you reread your work?
Sometimes it does bring me back, because I guess a lot of my work is kind of personal. So,
what do you feel about your cartoons being the most autobiographical ones in The New Yorker?
Definitely, there's a part of me that is that voice of sorry, mm-hmm. sorry, you know. I mean, sometimes I wish that I did a whole different kind of work, you know. But I always think there's that Yiddish, you know, if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a wagon.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I were a very different person, then I would do different cartoons.
Are you terrified of people?
Oh, yeah. It's, and I know that everything that I say this afternoon, I'm going to rewind in my head and regret.
Oh, no.
And that is just what, I mean, I'm just almost, I wouldn't quite say used to it, but I just know that that's.
I still regret some things that I've said to you like a year ago.
And I probably
won't. I think about it all the time.
It's just like a regretter's festival.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a very big fan of your work in the magazine, too.
Thank you.
I love seeing it, and I love God finding all of the prayers of mankind in his spam folder. I think it's just sensational.
Thanks. I mean, I don't care about them. I mean, I love working. I don't care if they're good. If I cared, I would be paralyzed.
Well, do you have ways that you sort of trick yourself of kind of getting out of that?
Yeah, I think it might have been easier for me if I were a guy and encouraged to be assertive.
Do you feel that like making jokes sometimes, like comedy, is a way of being assertive and expressing anger that like you can be like very indirect about it?
Yeah. Yeah. I never even thought of myself as funny, and I still don't. I think of myself as really needing to express myself, and I think for some people that's the same thing. I kind of think for you it's the same thing.
For me, it doesn't seem to work to like deliberately like try to be funny. I mean, I might make something that then I think, well, that's really a pretty good joke. That's pretty funny, but it's not funny.
Yeah.
I remember drawing things that made me laugh when I was really little.
Yeah.
And that I liked that. I mean, I think when I got to be a certain age, it was like things came out funny, and I didn't really want them necessarily to come out funny, but they came out funny. Like, you know, drawing horses, and I could not draw horses because I'm not a horse. I didn't like, not like horses.
When I wrote you some fan mail when I was 15, a lot of it was praising your horses. And then your magnificent letter that you wrote back to me contained some drawings of horses.
Big
teeth.
Yes, I just actually was drawing some horses the other day just for fun. And I'll show them to you. I have them right here. I was just kind of, I was trying to explain to somebody the horse drawings that I did when I was a kid.
So it's a page of watercolor paper with 20 horses on it. And all of them have kind of hair that was cool in the 90s, like sticking straight up. And also this very game grin on their faces, kind of like bros.
You know Highlights for Children?
Oh, yes.
Quasi-educational magazine for children. It was often in dentists' offices and waiting rooms. And they had this thing, Our Own Page. And I wanted to get a drawing onto Our Own Page when I was around 10. And I noticed that most of the drawings that were accepted by little girls were of horses, or quite a number of them were. And so one day I decided I was going to, God damn it, I was going to learn to draw horses. I was going to make myself draw horse after horse until I got it right. And I filled up this sketchbook with drawings of horses. And then I looked at them and I laughed so hard that I nearly like lost, you know, control of bodily functions. It was, they were just so terrible, but they were so funny. And hello, we hear you.
What's it like when you get letters from young women? Do you feel this huge responsibility? People like me probably send you very personal letters in which they maybe think that you're their mom or something. Is it, what's it like?
Well, I feel like women relate to each other differently from the way men relate to each other. And I don't know. I mean, when I give talks and stuff, it's mostly women in the audience, different ages, but mostly women, but guys too.
I do think there's something different in how we're made, but I also wonder whether there's so many more obstacles for a woman to become something like a cartoonist, that maybe the women who, and the obstacles are very insidious and invisible, such as I don't see anyone like me doing this, so I'm not even going to try. So I wonder if the women who do make it are people who are really, really honest. And I wonder if, like, the way your cartoons are different is you happen to be a really honest person and you're not going to fall into a form that doesn't come from inside of you.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how this relates to that exactly, but I think I felt like, well, you probably won't like me anyway, so I might as well do what I want to do.
Roz Chast is the author of countless great cartoons, and she's got a new book out next month, a collaboration with Patricia Marks. It's called, and you might want to write this down, Why Don't You Write My Eulogy Now So I Can Correct It? A Mother's Suggestions. Liana Fink's latest book is called Passing for Human, and I'm David Remnick. That's the show for today. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.